Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our second special ISF podcast of the week. This is Carl. Rachel's taking the day off. She's not feeling particularly well. Sinuses have hit. I can understand that. But tonight, we're very, very happy to welcome back a good friend and also quite a talented filmmaker and ISF member. So definitely say hello, Daniel. This is Daniel Kramer.
Hi there. How are you?
Not too bad. How about yourself?
I'm great.
So anyway, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on is that you have some very, very special news about a film that you directed that's now being released by Kino Lorber. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about Overwhelm the Sky, and then I'll also chime in at the end because I was actually at the premiere, New York City premiere of that, and that's where I met you. So
yeah, that's, I met you in person at the I think it was November 2019, so not too long before the lockdowns and everything. The characteristic that is often brought up first is that it's a movie on the longer side. It's nearly 3 hours. When I knew it was going to be turning out that way, I decided to release it in a old-fashioned roadshow style with overture, intermission, and track day and printed programs and all that jazz, because I swore to myself a long, long time ago that if I ever made a movie of any inordinate length, that I would try to release the film that way. So when it was looking more and more like the film was going to have to, when it was long, and when I knew that it had to stay long, and when it tested well, and it got really good reviews and notices from critics. It was logical to me to keep my promise to myself and do the roadshow. Release it in that style of the old fashioned epics of the day. It was a project that began we began shooting in November of 2016, so a full presidential cycle ago. Who had just been elected. So I was down in the dumps about that and a few other things, around that time, as a job that I was lined up for, actually editing a film at, American Zoetrope. I live in San Francisco. So, that's a real film nexus. So that had been, postponed at the time. I wound up on that job later in time. But I was wondering where the next check was going to come from. That was the other thing. And really most important of all, my mentor, I should say I have two mentors. My first original mentor, Paul Silbert, had died just earlier that month. I was very glum and very, you know, very emotionally kind of out of whack around that time. And it was my longtime cinematographer, Aaron Hollander, who I've been working with since 2007, who said, let's just, you've been talking about a weekend feature where we shoot the whole thing in a weekend. Let's just get out and do something, do that film, you know, just begin a project. And I was like, okay, you know, what are we going to do? And I looked in my idea index, which I keep, and I thought that we could do the novel, the American Gothic novel, Edgar Huntley, or Memoirs of a Sleepwalker. I was convinced that we could do that cheaply or in a micro-budget fashion. Little did I know that it was going to be it was going to cost some money, and that it was not going to be just a weekend. It was going to be many weekends over the course of 2 years and whenever we could grab time. It was really an independent endeavor in every sense of the word. That's how the film came to be. I had to kind of pinch myself because I couldn't believe that this film became the breakthrough film for me because of the length and because it's also in black and white. That's the old William Goldman line, is that nobody knows anything. You never know how the alchemy that is, filmmaking is going to, how all the elements are going to mix and how well, how effectively it's going to touch or impact people who were seeing it. And this one, just seemed to speak to more people. It was above average in my case. So it got excellent reviews and I couldn't be happier.
Well, I tell you what, in seeing the film in November of 2019, I was struck by a couple of things. You mentioned your cinematographer. The black and white photography on that film is just glorious. Seriously.
Thank you. That's Aaron Hollander, who's a very, very talented guy. I've been working with him for, as I said, many years.
Yeah, and Aaron does a great job. The other thing that really hit me, and your cast is really good, but being a musician, the musical score to that is just, again, glorious. I love the score to that.
Oh, yes, that's an original score by Kostas Dafnis, who's a local. He actually teaches at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. And so we have a full orchestral score with some experimental instrumentation. Kostas actually invented an instrument for the movie score, invented it himself. It looks like rather something from outer space. It's a big kind of stainless steel plate with a bunch of rods sticking out of it, and you bow the rods, and they each make a kind of a ringing tone that really resonates. So he combined that with an orchestral score. And there's actually, for those who buy the, the film through Kino Lorber, it's going to be available on VOD, of course, all the major platforms, but it'll also be on DVD. And I just say I highly recommend getting the disc because there are a lot of extras on the disc, including a mini documentary that's about 10 minutes long about Kostas and his music in the film, and the instrument that he invented for the score. So yeah, that's Kostas is a virtuoso. I've worked with many composers; they're all great. They've all been great to work with. But I think Kostas, he can do anything. I think he's a very, very talented guy, and I think we're going to keep on working together. I found my John Williams or my Bernard Herrmann with Kostas.
Now, one of the things I do want to mention in terms of, okay, so you made the film over 2 years. You did the festival circuit and such. And it seems tell us basically the type of reviews, or did it win any awards, and how did that translate into Kino Lorber then picking it up and deciding to release it on DVD?
It was tricky. We did show at a number of international film festivals. It is very tricky getting a film of that length into festivals, particularly American festivals nowadays. What really put it over the edge was a number of really esteemed critics going up to bat for it, namely Gerald Peary, there are a number of others, but FX Feeney, before he died, also gave it a really, really excellent review. But Gerald and FX, Jerry and FX, were very instrumental. Their raves, each of them, because of that, the film, I think, was passed off with a lot more behind it a lot more weight. As a result, more people saw it, more people wanted to program it. And,
if there's enough interest and there's enough of a following for the film, it'll wind up getting some type of attention vis-a-vis distribution. It was a little tricky in my case, though, because throughout 2020, which was a real – I'm not sure if I can curse on this show, but
– Yeah, you can curse all you want.
Okay, it was a real shit show of a year, as we know. There was something that was lined up pre-pandemic that kind of flew right out the window when theaters closed and the lockdown began and everything, and that put a real crimp in the original plan. I have a number of people to thank at Kino, namely number one Jonathan Hertzberg and number two Frank Tarzi, and really number three Rob Sweeney, who took a shine to the film. And I'd been working mainly. I didn't know Rob or Jonathan as well as I work with Frank a fair amount because I do a number of commentaries for Kino as well as a few other companies. But Studio Classics is kind of its own division. They don't, of course, deal with any really new titles. It kind of went up, through the food chain, and they got a deal on the table because Jonathan Hertzberg really quite liked the film a great deal, and also I think the rest of the acquisitions team also liked it and wanted to do something with it, they drew up the contract, and that's how we wound up there. Which I, really couldn't be happier. I mean, they've put out so many really gutsy, really this kind of progressive, I'm not saying political, but I'm saying artistically progressive film works on their label and of course, I mean, also some very challenging films and they've gotten and those works have gotten the best circulation that they could have ever dreamt of. So it's really the ideal company, the ideal label, it was just a match made in heaven for this particular film. And when they agreed to put it out, I was like, it was time for it was time for drinks, it was time for beers. So yeah, that's how that happened.
And of course, I noticed your post. If you have too many beers, they're going to overwhelm this guy. So,
yeah, that's my.
I love that pun, by the way. Love that pun.
We should point out that my boyfriend. It was my birthday recently. He got me a mug with the poster of the film on one side of the. Of the mug of this beer stein, and then on the other, it was an inside joke that a lot of the people involved in the film have said it's like overwhelm this guy, as in like a guy. So he said one more beer might overwhelm this guy, kind of an inside joke, which I thought it was a great gift.
Oh, absolutely. So I would take it that this film now, I should say that. This is not by any means your first film. You've been doing films since, if I'm not mistaken, 2007. And so you have, a good 6-7 features under your belt. But this would be the film that I would think that really has gotten the best distribution for you, correct?
Without a doubt, yeah. Yes, I mean, I've been, my first film really was, there was an era where I was, kind of coming up, trying to make my initial films and really just kind of getting out there, getting my hands dirty and just trying to develop into a better director, because I think a lot of directors get on their first major set and they, it becomes very daunting very easily. I told a friend who was directing his first film recently the bit of wisdom that Kubrick told Spielberg. And he said that the hardest part about directing a film is getting out of the car, because once you set foot out of the car that drives you to the set on a given morning, you realize, okay, well, no more time to be nervous. I'm in it now, and I got to think on my feet. And you know, it's like that one last moment before you get out of the car. It's like, well, gulp, here we go.
Exactly.
So I haven't really had to deal with that terribly much because I got early training on very low budget, micro budget features that I made when I was way back in film school. I made a feature in 07, Sophisticated Acquaintance, which is like just archly arty, I want to say. Just, you know, it's never going to get any major eyes on it. It's just, it was a major experimental type film based on the early BBC experimental biopics by Ken Russell and a little Peter Watkins, and not exactly what you call commercial. There was that one, there's a lot to blanch at in the film, but there's also some interesting things that my young, impetuous self was could be occasionally be inventive. But I mean, you know, there are of course things that I kind of get a little blush or embarrassment.
Actually,
kind of looking
did
at
that?
It.
Yeah, I did that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So there was a trip to Swarades. They made a film in India. They were all kind of much more art house inclined and didn't have much of a, I don't know, did, I guess that, you know, the selling points of them were not as as promising, I guess, as you know, any majors would have wanted perhaps, but or would have desired when they were looking at it as a prospect. I did have early luck in getting my India film and a couple others on Fandor when it was first a thing. I was one of the early people up on Fandor. But I mean, you know, Razor Kids on Seltzer I thought would do well because it, you know, it's about cults and there was a kind of an upsurge in cult material and films, and it had Barry Newman from Vanishing Point in a role, kind of a little part. And the film I made after that was Azor Kinegdo, which featured Josh Safdie of the Safdie brothers, and was about, you know, kind of Jewish-Polish, kind of a friendship between a young Orthodox Jew and a young Polish Catholic, and how that information is, that friendship is informed by cultural and historical baggage. And I thought that one would do better, but that didn't quite work the way that I thought it would. So when Overwhelm came along, I was like, I just want to make this one for myself. I don't care if it sells. I just want to, you know, I just kind of need to exercise some demons in a way. And then, irony of ironies, it's the one that does the best on the marketplace. So, you know, you never know. That's the what I said about the Goldman line. No one knows anything.
I also have talked to several filmmakers in low budget, micro budget, and a number of them say once you start to make a film, you're making it for yourself, really.
Yeah.
You don't try to make it for somebody else. You make it, and hopefully people will connect to it. I do have a question in terms of Over on the Sky. I know it took you like 2 years to do it. But one of the things I always say to people who are trying to do their first films and that sort of thing is to get people that are as adamant about the project as you are, you know, that they're taken with it and that they have the passion that you do. And the one thing I did want to say, which I really didn't say when we were talking about Overwhelm the Sky, is the cast itself. I think the cast of that film just did a marvelous job. And I was very, very lucky to meet several of them, too. And if you talk to them again, just tell them I thought they really did a great job. And also that they really, you know, to stick 2 years, you know, doing weekends and still do it and still feel fresh about it. And that takes, you can't buy that type of commitment. You just can't do it.
That's true. It's more in quantity out in San Francisco. It's one of the reasons I moved out here. I always say that if you're going to make a film like this, you need a good army of co-conspirators. You need people who are going to, you know, want to hatch these kind of crackpot schemes with you, and you need a team to do that, and you need to find your people is the important thing. And really, I got the talent pool out here is quite extraordinary, and you know, they're all very not only willing but enthusiastic, and they bring their A game each time. Just each of them surprised me in any number of ways. And, I mean, of course, the way that I work is we, of course, you know, had the novel, the Edgar Huntley, our memoirs, our Sleepwalker novel on which the movie is based. But there's also I'd come up with an idea, and then the actor would say, like, this is what I think about it, and this is what I want to do. And, you know, at the end of the process, it's just like, you know, whose idea really was it? To begin with, because it's been built from each other. It's a really you should foster a kind of as much of a dynamic process as possible. And that's, I think, it's the secret sauce for a film like that. You know, I was constantly surprised and changing things on a moment's notice based on an idea that they had, or a kind of a conception that they had of a character moment that I could use, and to kind of mine gold out of, you know. So that was that. So the magical thing is that there's no lack of those types of people in the in the Bay Area at large. It's a really extraordinary place to be and to create.
Well, one of the things that I think we should at least make clear is that you really don't work with a script. You work more with an outline and then let your actors improvise and sort of like hit the major points in that particular scene that you want. That, I think I read that's how you work.
Yes. I've over the years, that's been my kind of go-to for process. More and more, I've been writing more and coming at it with a more of a specificity, I guess, but always leaving enough room open for in the moment invention, which I think is the really good stuff, the most important stuff that comes out of. I've never storyboarded a single shot in my life. I don't believe in that. And in point of fact, most of the directors that I know, even people who don't improvise, do not believe in that. It's just, it's too dogmatic. And then you arrive on the set, and you know you kind of don't let the spirit move you, and you're not really feeling where you are. You're just coming to it. You've already made the movie on paper, and you're just kind of become an automaton. You're not going to be opening yourself up to what might happen if you just kind of let yourself go and let the place and let the set and let the actors and everything kind of take you along. And then, and of course, as a director, at the end of the day, you can say to people yes or no. Yes, I think that's an interesting idea. Well, let's see what happens when you do that. Or no, I don't think that's a good idea. So at the end of the day, you're the general. And you have the ultimate say so, but you want to leave open the possibility that everyone can bring their own notions, their own conceptions of how to make a scene how to, you know, really give it that extra energy and that extra, you know, kind of entry point, I guess, for people to be intrigued by it enough to want to keep watching.
So I want to move on a little bit in terms of what you're doing now. You actually have released another film, which I understand is a trilogy, which is called Even Just.
So the IMDb is not correct on that. I got to do something about that. But that movie's mostly shot. I haven't really put it together yet. I've been working on it. It's been my tweaking project for a while. It's a full feature indeed. It's using a wealth, gigantic pool of really extraordinary kind of 8mm film, home movie footage, and personal collections and whatnot. And of course, I shoot new material about collector of these things, of these clips and everything, and how he gets, you know, kind of taken for a ride by a con man because he's a dreamer, and, you know, he's less concerned with the practical matters of daily life than he is these kind of, more creative things. It's kind of, I think, what Cassavetes was after, for instance, in Killing of a Chinese Bookie, where you had the Ben Gazzara character who was kind of a ragtag artist in his own way. And, the kind of the shows that he puts on at his club are his pride and joy. And as far as he's concerned, just these practical matters and these kind of mobster guys are just getting in the way of the process of creating. So in that sense, you have the character in Even Just, who is kind of a film, a motion picture, as in, you know, celluloid film enthusiast. And he's too much of a dreamer to realize that he's being conned out of money. So I've been working on that for a while and trying to, it's going to take a little while to figure out a way to integrate just this wealth of archival footage that I've collected that I want to weave into the narrative in a really, in an organic, but a very aggressive way at the same time. I don't want to not use those things. It has to be very careful, and I want it to be as integrated
organic
into as much as possible. So it's going to take a little time and trickery, I want to say. So that's not quite ready yet.
Okay. Now, I also know that over the period of time, particularly during COVID, that you have done a lot of commentaries. So why don't you let us know some of the films that you've done commentaries on?
Over the pandemic alone, I've done dozens of the tracks that kept me. I mean, that was one of the things that kept me sane during that time. Doing these with a number of companies. I worked for AGFA, I worked for, you know, Shout Factory, I worked for Scorpion, I worked for Kino, I did a number of tracks for various companies that are releasing these discs. Do you want highlights? I did so
yeah,
many
yeah,
last year.
Yeah, give us
year.
A couple of highlights for sure. I know one film that was just put out, posted at ISF, I know you did the commentary for, and that's Get Crazy with Alan Arkin.
Okay. Yeah, well, yes, that actually hasn't been technically announced yet. I don't think they mind. So Alan is producing a ton of extra features. I'm not going to get into the weeds with them here. I'm in touch with Alan on a, pretty regular basis. We chat off, and he's telling me what he's getting and everything. But I did that with Alan, and there's a third individual on the track with us that I think people are going to really be tickled by. Stay tuned for the official announcement of who that third individual on the track with us is. I was really happy to have done the Ipcress file commentary track with Troy Hellworth last year. And that Kino put that out. So there are two commentaries, the original one that Sid Fury had done with Peter Hunt back in 1998 for the Anchor Bay release. And then the new one has Troy and myself talking about Icarus Fall. So that was a thrill.
And we should also mention that you, of course, wrote a book about Sidney Fury. He's actually sort of a mentor to you, isn't he?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier my first original mentor was Paul Stelberg, who was a Hollywood production designer, to whom, by the way, Overwhelm, you know, the sky is dedicated. The opening dedication is for Paul. Mm-hmm. My second mentor and still with us and, you know, very important figure in my life every day is Sidney Fury, who I'm, you know, I chat with often. But I was privileged to have recorded also the commentary for the Leather Boys with him back in February. And that just came out in June from AGFA and from Shout Factory. That was a great project. He and I are doing another commentary for a relatively new company, which I don't think I can say quite yet. But it's one of the I think I can mention it's one of the Fury films pre 1984. Kind of broad because he began in the late 50s, but it's a pre 1980 mid 80s film from Fury, and it's an important film, I think, in his career, and we're like doing that soon. So I did that with him. I also Chick Venera recently passed. He recently died. So I was able to record a Milagro Beanfield War commentary with him, which I was happy to do. And I did the public eye, the Joe Pesci public eye with its writer director Howard Franklin. That was a lot of fun. Howard and I have since become friends. He's a very good guy. I did The Hard Way with John Badham and Rob Cohen. I also did Bird on a Wire with Badham and Cohen. They're always a fun team to do those with. Did a number with Alan Arkush, actually. We did two Carol Lombards, Hands Across the Table and The Princess Comes Across. I did Rosebud, the Otto Preminger film, on my own. It's been a very, very busy year of gabbing, I guess I should say. Been a lot of gabs.
Well, I'm glad you had some time to gab with us. You know, you're probably getting tired of doing all this talking.
I talk a lot. It's kind of my what I do for income nowadays. Which is ironic because I grew up with a stutter and now I'm paid to talk. So the irony. Life is funny, right? I have to say something about that, actually,
because there are those of us that have gone through difficulties, and I actually had cerebral palsy. But anyone who overcomes something like a stutter or anything like that, I give you props, man. Seriously.
Oh, thank you.
Seriously.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, that to me is something very special.
Thank you. I've done a few that haven't been announced yet, which are very exciting, including there's one that I think people will plots over, which I don't think I can announce yet.
Don't keep us in suspense and then come back and tell us about it.
There are a couple coming up that I think people are going to be really stoked to hear about. Stay tuned in that department. I mean, I did it was just a very, very good, busy year of chatting and talking about movies and, you know, getting some form of reward, whether that be payment or discs. So that's been a nice thing.
So one other thing I do want to mention, and we actually talked about it before the podcast, is that yesterday we were very happy to have Stephen Eckleberry on. And
yeah.
We talked about, he's the widower of Karen Black. And Karen had done all of these demos in that back in the 70s. And they found the tapes, and they were able to produce an album. And you actually know Karen and know Stephen. And so tell us a little bit, because Stephen talked about certain things where Karen would always sing and that sort of thing. So give us just a little bit of background on that, too. Tell us a story about Karen.
I've known Karen, or I knew Karen, and I've known Stephen since around 2006 or 2007. I developed a really good friendship, it was close enough with Karen where she had a nickname for me and would call me, on the regular, she called me Dank, because I appeared on her phone as Dan K. She would call and say, "Hello, darling," or "Hello, Dank, it's Karen." Mainly if she didn't have a nickname for you, she'd say, "Hello, darling, it's Karen." In my case, it was, "Hello, Dank, it's Karen." She would leave these wonderful, lengthy stream of consciousness voicemail messages. If you didn't happen to answer the phone, you'd get a kind of a novel that kind of went this way, that way, and everywhere. I was just a lad out of film school at the time, and I went out to L.A. And I had met Karen and Stephen and a bunch of other people, Henry Jaglom, at two film festivals actually. When I didn't have anywhere else to go, Karen and Stephen opened up their guest room at the time. They were living on Saugus in Sherman Oaks, and they opened up their guest room, and I was able to crash there for about a month while I was trying to get my foothold in the industry, take care of some things. And she was a very, very generous individual, and she kept a lot of cats. I love cats myself. I have two myself. So she had a number of cats that I lived with her. I listened to about 5 minutes of that of your show yesterday. You played a clip from Born to Win, and my all-time kicking myself story is that I watched Born to Win with Karen, and we did an unrecorded commentary track on the film, you might say, where she if only I didn't have a recorder, otherwise I would have recorded it. But I sat there and watched Born to Win with her back then, when I was living there, when I was her house guest. But she had the habit of spontaneously bursting out into song. She did love to sing. I remember we were at a film festival in Humboldt in Northern California, and they were it was like a filmmaker field trip organized by the festival head or the committee or whatever, and they put us in vans, and they sent us up to this redwood forest, and it was a bit of a lengthy ride, and it was just like a song fest the whole time. She'd be singing either an old standard or one of her own compositions, and she was very she loved to laugh. She loved she'd always loved when I laughed, and she'd always say, "He's always laughing, isn't he, darling?" I remember that. She was just a very, very generous soul. And when I attended her memorial service, it was just a very overpowering emotional experience for everyone there. because like the people who got up and talked, you know, about having known her, I remember, you know, Paul Sorvino was completely in tears, remembering her. I remember Elliot Gould got up and, here's a great Karen story that Elliot told at the memorial that I don't think has been seen or reported anywhere else. Elliot got up and said, you know, I was in a film with Karen in the late 70s called Capricorn One, and she plays a news reporter, and I'm just this would-be muckraker at some crappy paper. And there's a scene where she picks me up from prison, but we don't see, you know, the scene where I call her to say, hey, I'm in prison, bail me out. And I remember she said, what do you think that phone conversation was like? He's like, I don't know, Karen, but we're Peter, the director, Peter Hyams, he wants to shoot, so we should get over there. And he seems to be, you know, in a hurry. He's under the gun. He's like, no, Bass, let's improvise a phone conversation. What happened right before the scene? He's like, Karen, no, he wants us over there right now. And he kept on, arguing with her and fighting her over it. And all of a sudden, you know, the more that he fought, all of a sudden he just hears her say, ring, 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 ring. And, you know, at that point he just couldn't get out of it. So, that was a classic type of – and, of course, one person got up and talked about the way that she used to give directions to people when you were driving. And, you know, she was really, driven by art and beauty. So if she wouldn't tell you, take a left at the post office, she'd say, make a left at the big brick building, and you're going to see a tree, a beautiful tree. And it's not exactly helpful if you're trying to get somewhere, but very entertaining to hear her talk about that. But she was just a very one of my favorite people I've ever met in my life, and I miss her every day. And I actually just talked to Stephen. He called me after your show yesterday, so we hadn't spoken in a little while. We kind of caught up for a bit, and that was nice to talk to him again.
Good. Well, I'm glad that happened. Again, Daniel, I'm very, very glad that you had some time to join with us and talk about everything. Now, before you go, give us a little bit of promo on where we can see Over One the Sky when it's released. Also, your older films, too, which were on Fandor, are they available anywhere, like Seltzer? And
they were on Fandor. Raise the Kids on Seltzer is on Troma, actually. Uncle Lloyd made me an offer I couldn't refuse, so that's on Troma now. Which is fine. I'm personally fond of that film. I know it's not for everybody. That's up there. People can see that there. Isa Connecto, I haven't really done much with. It was kind of a very, very personal film. And, I don't think there are some people who say it's my best film, including Rob Nielsen, local filmmaker, local kind of icon, thinks that that's the best film that I've made. And a couple other people too, but when it came out, it didn't get great reviews, and I don't think the festival crowd really got it, and so I just kind of shelved that, and I haven't really done much with it since then. Maybe one day it'll find its audience or it'll get out there again. But right now, I haven't really done much with that. The other films, I mean, you know, contact me. I can give you links. They're not. Not really. They were on Fandor for a while, as I said, my early films like Sophisticated Acquaintance and A Trip to Swadades and Idiot Maker's Gravity Tour aren't going to gel maybe for the major companies because they're just too arty. I don't know. Maybe I'll get a box set one day in my dreams, right?
Well, one of the things now is with Over One the Sky and with that getting a release, and also what other projects do you have in the works, because I had heard a couple possibilities that you might have a TV series happening or something like that.
Right. That's COVID, you know, COVID strikes again, but that's actually still in the running from one of the major networks. So hopefully that'll eventually happen. The film that I'm working on now is not even my script. It's another writer, but I'd be, you know, directing it, and it's very interesting material. I'm not at liberty to talk about it publicly now, but it's a very compelling story. I'm very excited to do it, and we're attracting some name actors at the moment. So you know, you never quite know if a film is going to go until you're on the set the first day, because right. You know, in this crazy business, the rug can be yanked out from under you within a matter of days before, you know, you go. I mean, the ultimate horrific example would be, you know, Fred Zinnemann. He'd been working for I think about 3 years on Man's Fate by Mulroe, and then James Aubrey got in at MGM, and the whole thing was canceled within they were about to shoot within 3 days, and it was canceled. So, you know, you just never know until you're on set and it's actually going, so that you're actually going to be doing making it. So yeah, it's the way that it goes in this crazy business, but alas,
it's the way it is, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, we'll certainly keep our fingers crossed and wish you all the good luck in the world.
Thank you.
Again, you're welcome back anytime, Daniel.
Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to have you. Just to let people know, tomorrow on Deviant Legion, we have the return of the Prodigal Son. That would be Lawrence Marshall, who used to be with us and did Terror with a Twist of Lines. He has been working on his own project, and he's coming back to tell us about it. And that would be Ice Screams and various things that's happening with that. On Friday, Adam Ferenz and everybody is going to be doing a podcast on the film from Mel Brooks. And then on Saturday, we're going to be doing a commentary watch of The 12 Chairs, which is one of Mel Brooks's lesser-known films, but one of my favorites. So that's what we're going to be doing this week. We also have several people not lined up in stone yet, but Trent Harris is going to be with us. We have a gentleman, I can't think of his name right now, but wrote a book about Spike Jonze, and we're going to be having him on in mid to late August. We're going to be continuing our series of Down the Rabbit Hole with my co-host Rachel, and those are music shows, and we'll be doing one in 2 weeks. So that's what we have here. Again, Daniel, thank you so much for being with us, and keep in touch and let us know what's going on. All right.
Well, okay. Thank you, Carl.
You're very welcome, and thank you very much for listening, folks. Have a good night, and we'll see you tomorrow. Good night, Daniel. Thank you, Brunch.
Good night. Thank you. Okay.
Bye-bye.